love your work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative entrepreneur. Find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you want the very best of Love Your Work and the gems that I've discovered in my thousands of hours of research into history's greatest creators, all in a short weekly email, sign up for my Love Mondays newsletter at cadavy.net/Mondays. Vincent van Gogh was a loser and a failure. He failed as an art dealer and as a preacher. He even got fired and banned from his own family's business. On top of that, Van Gogh had terrible health problems. His gums were sore, he was losing weight, he had a hacking cough. He was also prone to psychotic episodes during which he would have to be institutionalized for months at a time. And Vincent never really found his place in the world. It's pretty sad. He died young, only 37. I recently read an incredible biography of Van Gogh. By the end, I was left wondering, what can you possibly learn from this tragic life and this great creator? Stephen Nafee is co-author of the incredible Van Gogh, The Life. It is a 900-page treasure chronicling the life of an artist who is so revered that tourists bring their relatives' ashes to spread over his gravesite in Auvers, France. Stephen and his co-author and partner, Gregory White-Smith, spent more than a decade compiling Van Gogh's biography. To do so, they had to sort through mountains of letters and literature from the period of Van Gogh's life. And since neither of them spoke Dutch, they worked with more than 20 translators and researchers just to complete the book. The result is a Van Gogh biography of unparalleled depth, painting in intricate detail the outer and inner life of Vincent Van Gogh. And we're going to hear about that today. In this conversation, you'll learn, most people think Vincent Van Gogh died in obscurity, but that's actually not true. Why is that? Why is it that, as he languished in an asylum, Vincent's work was actually exploding in popularity? Many people also believe that Vincent Van Gogh committed suicide. How did Nafee and Smith come to change the opinion of even the most studied Van Gogh historians? And what can you possibly learn from the tragic success of Vincent Van Gogh? Stephen shares insights about what he and his late partner and co-author learned from studying Van Gogh's life. It's surprising and it's really touching. I want to start showcasing you and your work right here on Love Your Work with a listener showcase. Here's how it's going to work. Apply to be showcased at cadavy.net/showcase. It's a really short application. I'm going to pick one lucky listener to mention on the show. I'll talk about your work, where our listeners can find you. And I've been trying to find new ways to show love for the listeners that I have. And I think this would be a good start. So again, that is cadavy.net/showcase to be featured right here on Love Your Work. Can't wait to feature your work. cadavy.net/showcase. Here's historian and artist Stephen Nafee on Vincent Van Gogh. I'm here with Steve Nafee, the co-author of Van Gogh, The Life. And Van Gogh is such an interesting figure, Steve. And I think that a lot of people, one of the things they believe about him is that, oh, he died unknown. He never sold a painting. But that's not precisely true, right?
No. At the very end of his life, in the last year of his life, a writer in Paris, a young symbolist poet, wrote an article that basically said that this crazy person in an insane asylum in southern France was the greatest living artist. And many, many people in the art world and the sort of elite world of Paris saw that article. Van Gogh also sold a painting for 400 francs to a woman named Anna Bock in the last year of his life. And he had several exhibitions, but he was included in an exhibition in Brussels shortly before he died. And artists as important as Theo van Rijsselberg and Claude Monet, who were also in that show, said about Vincent that this is some of the most important, interesting work in this exhibition. So he had already begun to get some attention just before he died.
So how close was this to when he did die?
The exhibition was about 6 months. It was, I believe, January. I could be wrong, but I think it was January of 1890, and he died in July.
And then that article was kind of the thing that put him on the map?
Well, the exhibition and the article, the article was a little bit, the other person Greg and Smith and I wrote about was Jackson Pollock, and the article in Life magazine, in which posed the question, using the critic Clement Greenberg's words, is Pollock the greatest living artist, had the same sort of galvanic effect. It sort of got people to look very closely and to begin to wonder, is this thing that looks so unusual, not just unusual, but perhaps really important? And so a single article, at least back then, not today it probably wouldn't have the same effect with all the platforms out there. But back then, a single article could rivet the sort of attention of the art world.
Mm-hmm. And Van Gogh died at 37. Pretty much his entire art career was about 10 years, right?
The whole career was about 10 years. The important paintings, by and large, there were some earlier than that, were done in the last 4 years of his life. And the sort of iconic masterpieces that we know him for were done in the last 2 years of his life. It's only afterwards, I mean, if he had died at 34 or 33 instead of 37, I don't think we would know who he was. But now that we do know who he is, we can look back at the earlier work and see not just signs of the genius there, but some very beautiful paintings. They just weren't revolutionary enough or exciting enough to have attracted much attention. It's only in the after the really great works were done that we can go back and look at those earlier works and see that even though he hadn't come together as an artist, there was great painterly intelligence early on.
But yet at the same time, in the early years, he was kind of ridiculed for his style and skills. Is that right?
Yes, I'm talking about what we in 2019 might see.
Yeah.
Back then, in fact, even towards the very end, his only financial support came from his brother Theo. He's rather famous. The relationship between the two of them is very famous, partly because we know Van Gogh as a human being, mostly from the letters that he wrote Theo, and which Theo, thank God, kept. Many people also know that Theo provided him with a stipend for his entire adult life. And without that stipend, Van Gogh simply wouldn't have existed. But even Theo didn't think much of Van Gogh's work until the others began to say something positive about it. So not only the art world as a whole, and even those few people who sort of knew Vincent's work early on, no one took it seriously until the last year of his life.
Well, that's an interesting fact about him is that his uncle owns like the leading art dealership in all of Europe, right?
Yes, his uncle and namesake, also Vincent Van Gogh, started an art gallery with the Van Gogh name, and he sold it to the premier gallery in the world at the time in Europe, Goupil, and it became part of Goupil. And one of the shocking things about Vincent's life is that long before he became a painter, it was assumed that he would go to work for his uncle and that he would even inherit the dealership because his uncle had no children. And Vincent's father was very close to the uncle Vincent. And as the eldest son, it was assumed that Van Gogh would go work for the gallery, which he did at age 15, and that he would ascend the ladder and eventually take over the enterprise. And that simply didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an interesting thing that you would think that if you had those ties in your family and when you did finally start an art career, that would become a tremendous advantage. Was that an advantage to any degree?
Well, it was an artistic advantage in the following sense. Van Gogh had this unbelievably intense and active eye, and he looked very closely at art he loved art of many different kinds. He famously said once that we need to love more art more. And so the fact that he worked in a dealership, one that not only handled paintings, but also handled prints, meant that Van Gogh had it's hard for us now, all these years later, and with the internet available to us, to realize just how difficult it was to access large numbers of works of art back then. I mean, there were some museums, and Van Gogh went to them, but to be in an art gallery that processed not only hundreds but thousands of works of art, many of them in reproduction, but still processing them, was a huge artistic advantage to Vincent. It developed his eye. It developed an awareness of the entire tradition, at least of Western painting. And so there was this artistic advantage. But what you suggest is that it should have been a commercial advantage as well, a sort of strategic advantage. And it could have been. But Van Gogh was so troubled and so incapable of interacting with people in even any modicum of normalcy, of normality, that he literally was instead of ascending the ladder, he kept being demoted. He was demoted first from the gallery in The Hague to the sort of storeroom in the gallery in London, and then eventually to an even lesser job in the gallery in Paris. And then he was finally fired. And not only when he was fired, he was prohibited from ever stepping foot in the gallery again. Hmm. So he tore up basically the family relationships, both with his uncle, with his uncle's network of contacts, and even another uncle was a book dealer and sold some art, even the relationship with him. Basically, all these family relationships that could have been so advantageous to him in his art career were destroyed because of his complex psychological and psychiatric problems.
Well, it's amazing that he could have had that he could have, even in the family business, done so poorly that he became banned from ever returning there. What was it about his personality that was, or his interactions with other people that was so unpleasant?
Well, he was incredibly intense. Many of us have somebody in our life who is so intense that it's almost hard to be in their presence. There was a kind of manic. He spoke manically. He behaved manically. It was uncomfortable even for the members of his own family to be around him. But it exhibited itself in specific acts that were by themselves reason enough to fire him. For example, when he was in the Paris gallery, it's been recorded that clients would come up to him, or he would go over to them looking at a painting that he thought was one of the inferior paintings in the room, and say to them things like, "Oh, no, 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 you don't want to buy that. Only with somebody with terrible taste would want that. What you really should be looking at is this painting over here." Yeah, wow. And you can imagine his bosses didn't care for this behavior.
And what was his relationship with creating art at that point in time? Did he not really start his career as an artist for some time after?
Yes, he did. He did some childhood drawings, but nothing more than the average person out there might have done. Even though his mother did watercolors, but lots of middle class people, especially women, did that in the 19th century, and she was acquainted with some from a family named Backhuysen that had multiple painters of note in that family. And so Van Gogh, sort of not only through his uncle, but through these friends of his mother, was acquainted with the world of professional art. But none of that took hold. In fact, his first aspiration was to do well in the family gallery as a merchant, not as an artist. And when that didn't work out, he decided to become a preacher like his father. His father was a mm-hmm. minister So he decided to become a minister, but he went through the same downward tumble as a minister as he had as an art dealer. He tried to become a minister, but that required an enormous amount of education in the 19th century, including command of Latin and Greek, and he simply couldn't handle handle that, not from an intellectual standpoint, but again, from a personal standpoint. He just, with some sort of discipline issues. But then when that didn't work out, he decided to become a missionary, and that didn't work out either. So he ended up becoming what is called a cold porter, a term I didn't know until writing about Van Gogh. And that was somebody who literally handed out free copies of the Bible. And even that, he was fired from that job. And it was only in the complete desperation of that moment in his life, when everything seemed to have failed, that his brother Theo sent him teach yourself how to draw, a book that was prominent in the era, and some paper and pencils, and Van Gogh began drawing. And that's the point. He was about 27 when that happened, and that begins the last chapter of his life, and the one that made him arguably the most beloved artist in the world.
And as he's going through these various careers, he's sort of wandering around from place to place as well. Is that correct?
Yes. He lived, many people don't realize that he lived in England, three different places, as well as in multiple cities throughout the Netherlands. And eventually, as an artist, he spent the final years of his life in France. But as a result, he spoke heavily accented English, as well as Dutch, and had quite a decent command of German. And in the last years of his life, because he lived in France, he began to think in French, and he wrote his letters in French, and he essentially became a French speaker in the last years of his life.
And so as he starts this career as an, I mean, it's funny to even call it a career, is that he just gets this drawing book and starts drawing, but he really is approaching it as a career. That was the impression I got. Is that correct?
Yes. No, his level of ambition is a sort of interesting question. He couldn't approach something without doing it intensely, whether it was as a child collecting beetles and birds' nests, whether it was working in the gallery in The Hague, where he worked very hard. He may not have impressed his supervisors, but he worked intensely as a missionary. He was just it was a fierce thing to see him try to bring people into the faith. And then as an artist, he just worked incessantly. So in each of those stages of his life, there was a good deal of ambition, one could call it, except that he had so little self-confidence that even in this effort, he never really thought he would succeed. And when the article came out in 1890 by Aurier, the symbolist poet, that he was both incredibly gratified, but even more than that, he was horrified. He just simply couldn't imagine it. He couldn't understand that somebody took him seriously. And he, in fact, this is very interesting, actually. In order to justify his failure, he had in his, he had decided that that success is its own form of danger. And in fact, if he were by some mad circumstance to be successful, that his life would be even more difficult than it was as a failure. So when this writer, and then gradually a few people in the art world began to take notice of him, he actually was terrified of it. So he was not Monet, who at the end of his life was, patronized by the French state and was sort of a French national hero, and he was a friend of the prime minister. And Monet knew when he died just how important he was, as certainly Picasso did. Van Gogh had no sense of that whatsoever. He would be, if he saw the people lining up around the block every day at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, or at any of the retrospectives of his art that happened everywhere all the time. I mean, there are several in the United States right now, and I'm involved in three that will be taking place in 2019 and 2020. He would be shocked.
And then his gravesite, people leave all sorts of things there, correct?
Yes, it's almost a religious moment. If any of your listeners have been there, they will know that that hundreds of thousands of people go to Auvers, this town where he died. It's only 30 miles north of Paris, and it's almost like a pilgrimage. People go to see the room where he died, and they go to the gravesite, which is a very moving place. And visitors will come, and they will leave notes for him. They will leave, if they're artists, they will leave paintbrushes for him. Russians will pour vodka over the grave, which apparently is something that Russians do to sort of celebrate the dead. And Japanese Jewish visitors will put rocks or stones on the grave, and Japanese visitors have been known to bring the ashes of their ancestors to pour them on the grave so that they will live in eternity with the painter of Starry Night. I mean, that is, even Monet or Picasso don't generate anything approaching mm-hmm. that level of emotional commitment.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed was that you were talking about how he didn't really believe that he was that great, almost like he had imposter syndrome, it sounded like.
Yes, exactly. So that's the term we would use today.
Yeah, and that he thought so little of his work in a way that he overcompensated through this sort of compulsive creation of work. Is that what you think was going on psychologically?
Well, let me step back and say that even though he felt that he would never amount to anything. For example, he said that my role and the roles of many of my friends is simply to act as an interim presence between the great art of the past and the great art of the future that will come. But there were moments when contrarily, he had an intense, not so much ambition, because he never thought the world would care, but wanted to be taken seriously. So that, for example, when he painted the Potato Eaters, which was, you know, before the four last years of his life, it was in the fifth year before he died, painted in Holland in those very dark colors. You know, he painted it in the hopes that it would bring attention to him. And he spent an enormous amount of time describing to Theo what kind of frame he wanted on that painting and how many people he wanted to show Theo to show it to. And when Theo and a good friend, the only friend he had in his life, a man named Anton van Rappard, told Vincent that they didn't think the painting was any good, he was not just upset, but horrified and angry. So mixed in with all of the self-doubt that really essentially defined his entire life were moments of piercing desire for recognition.
Right. And did it also make him maybe critical of other artists, you know, as sort of a defense?
Yes, there was a considerable amount of that. He essentially made fun of some of the sort of cheesier artists, but really what was more typical of him was a kind of acceptance. And I don't know whether this came from some sort of subterranean feeling of solidarity with artists who had not been recognized, or whether it was, I think, more likely, and Greg thought, more likely a kind of generosity of spirit and a generosity of eye, that he really tried to see the best in other art. And the range of things that he admired was pretty astonishing. I mean, because he was manic as well, there are letters to Theo in which he will list a couple of dozen artists whose work he had seen recently, artists most of whom are not known to us today, that he wanted Theo to go look at because he thought there was something wonderfully admirable in their work. So, you know, he tried for the most part to see the best in other art, almost regardless of style.
Mm-hmm. And as I was talking about that, it seemed to me that he was very professional about his pursuit of art as a career, I was very surprised when I read about how much work he put into, say, the Potato Eaters. That, you know,
yes,
I'm thinking that he just sits in this people in these people's living room and does a painting of them, but it's not like that.
No, he did dozens and dozens of preliminary drawings. He also did a series of heads, he called it, not so much portraits, but heads of peasants, some of which are really just spectacular, notably of the peasant that he was sleeping with, a woman named Gordina de Groot. There's a spectacular painting, for example, at the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena from this series. So he did all those preliminary drawings, all the preliminary paintings, and then he worked for months on that painting. Now, that was not typical. The great masterpieces that we know were done fairly quickly. Some of the paintings at the very end were done in a day. But so the Potato Eaters is not symptomatic of the working style at the end of his career, but it also shows, as you just suggested, the focus and the attention to creating a fully realized work of art early on. In fact, he was so, he simply couldn't leave it alone. At one point, this is astonishing, after having essentially repainted it four or five times, he'd gotten to the point where he thought he more or less had what he wanted, and he took it to a nearby city and left it with somebody he knew so that he wouldn't be tempted to work on it anymore. Oh. And then he had to take a train to take it there. And the next morning, he got back on the train and retrieved it so he could work on it some more. So only when he sent it to Theo to be exhibited in Paris did he finally let go of the thing.
Wow. I mean, I guess I'm not super surprised that some of the earlier work he was putting a lot more time in, and then towards the end he was doing the paintings quite rapidly because he seemed to have such a well-defined style, and perhaps that sort of wandering as it is in the context of painting and making art was searching for that style.
I think that's perfectly put, David. I think that's that by the time he had arrived at something like a mature style, which certainly happened soon after he arrived in Arles, 2 years before he died, he had that mature style. It evolved somewhat over the course of that 2 years, partly because he painted so many works. In the last more than 2 months of his life, by the time he reached Auvers, he was painting almost a painting every single day. But by then, as you say, he had already arrived at a mature style, and it was a quick style. I mean, one of the things that is so miraculous about these paintings, and it rewards, you know, careful looking, which can even be done online. I mean, the quality of reproductions, thanks to the internet, can be really intense. I mean, the Van Gogh Museum itself, for example, posts incredibly high resolution and images of the paintings and of the major paintings in their collection. So you're able to go onto your computer, pull these paintings up, and study them very closely. And one thing you'll notice is that there's no overpainting. I mean, you can literally see the canvas peeking through the brushstrokes, and where the brushstrokes mix, it's, you know, painting wet and wet. It's not covering up an unsuccessful passage. It's essentially just there's almost no correction going on. It's just one miraculous brilliant brushstroke and one miraculous color combination after another. It's a kind of delirious genius that is rewards really close inspection. I mean, because the colors are so, of the mature works, are so intense and bright and beautiful, and because the compositions are so strong, it's easy to look at them and take the painting in one eye, in one moment, and as a result, many of them are iconic, like the boats at Saint Marie, or the bridge at Langlois, or the sunflowers, or the two chairs, his and Gauguin's, et cetera, because they have this iconic sort of incredibly powerful composition and these powerful color contrasts. But it really is worth taking a look at a single painting and studying it brushstroke by brushstroke, and seeing just how glorious these things are.
One thing I was impressed by reading some of the excerpts from letters and such was that he seemed to have a pretty sharp business sense about trying to carve out this career as, well, I guess for a while, maybe he was trying to be an illustrator, but then being an artist. I mean, was that anything remarkable to you?
Well, I think maybe what we're talking about here is the fact that from time to time, he would develop an enormous sense of guilt that he was taking so much money from his brother, or his brother, who could be quite the taskmaster, understandably, would write him and say, listen, I just can't keep on giving you more and more money. I have other people I'm responsible to, and I don't make that much money. And, you know, you're going to need to start making some money. And at those moments, he would talk up this career as a possible career as an illustrator, or that he would try to make photographs, or in one moment in Antwerp, that he would hand tint photographs. But these were very usually short-lived enterprises, short-lived partly because they weren't successful and he didn't bring in any money, but partly because he really just went back to being who he was. I mean, I think one of the, in some ways, I think one reason he became the great artist that he is, and one reason we love them so much is the authenticity. You know, they are incredibly authentic. In fact, Theo rued the fact that he would give Vincent suggestions about how to make more sellable paintings, and Vincent simply couldn't follow them. I mean, he simply had to do what he wanted to do. And I can give you an example. When Gauguin came to Arles, he painted very differently from Van Gogh. He sort of constructed the images. He didn't paint them from nature. He painted them from the head, as he called it, de tête in French. He would construct these things carefully, and then he painted them very slowly and very deliberately, not in a kind of headlong rush of genius. And Van Gogh, because he was so desperately lonely and wanted to keep Gauguin around, tried to paint like Gauguin several times, and he simply couldn't make it work. And he eventually had to go back to painting the way he needed to paint. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons. It isn't just the color, the palette, or the intensity. It's the authenticity that leads to, among other things, the German Expressionist movement. And so much art that follows Vincent flows from him. Certainly German Expressionism and even Fauvism. And one of the factors, one of the things that the German Expressionists loved about Van Gogh's work was this extreme authenticity.
It sounds like he was maybe kind of strategic with, like, when he was writing these things, where it seemed like he had some business savvy about carving out this career as an artist. So that was actually perhaps a strategy.
Well, I'll tell you where the strategy came in. Was mostly in the, and I think Greg was the first person to really fully understand this. You know, while I was reading the literature on Van Gogh generally, Greg spent 3 years reading Van Gogh's letters. And I remember him coming to me and saying, you know, these letters are not just casual records of his, you know, what's gone on in his life since the last time he wrote Theo. Because most of the letters we have are letters from him to Theo. He said, these things are carefully constructed. They are strategic, and they are mostly intended to get Theo to send more money. Mm-hmm. So he was capable of strategy and even of, I mean, one could call it, you know, it certainly had to do with his business since it was his source of money. He was more strategic there than he was. I actually, in the development of his painterly style, he really was somewhat oblivious to the prevailing styles in the art world, even the emerging styles. And he painted a few paintings like Monet. He tried to paint like Gauguin, but mostly he had to paint like himself. And you know, I think among the reasons he was this revolutionary figure is the fact that he painted by himself. You know, this was an era when the Impressionists often painted together. You know, many people know that Monet and Renoir painted together a number of times. And, you know, the paintings they did under those circumstances are very similar. And of course, Seurat created a whole, you know, the painter of La Grande Chatte, the Sunday afternoon in the park, that's in Chicago, you know, an entire school of pointillist painting developed around Seurat. And, the German Expressionists were after this, developed as a style. You know, Picasso and Braque, some of those early paintings, the early analytical Cubist paintings are very similar. Van Gogh really didn't paint like anybody. And it really was a kind of individual adventure that he lived.
And yet, as you mentioned in the book, there's a period of time where he's living in Paris and he's right, the Impressionists are right underfoot and he doesn't have contact with them at all.
Well, he certainly saw their paintings because he had such an inquisitive eye, and because he was in Paris, he was seeing their work in the exhibitions. He could see it at the gallery. His brother Theo did join the family gallery, and he was, when Vincent was there in Paris for those 2 years from 1886 to 1888, it was largely because his brother Theo was working as an art dealer there. And among the artists he showed were Gauguin and Monet. In fact, Theo had one of the first really major exhibitions for Monet and Rodin. So and because all these young artists who had a hard time finding dealers were beseeching Theo to show them, Theo certainly knew them, and he introduced Vincent to them. So during those years in Paris, Vincent got to know Guillaumin, he got to know Pizarro somewhat, he got to know Signac, he got to know several other artists. But at Toulouse-Lautrec, he met several times. But he didn't become really close to any of them for all the reasons we've already discussed. But it did have some impact on his art. And the principal impact was that he went, while he was in Paris, from the dark paintings of Holland, like the Potato Eater, to a much lighter and brighter palette, which was clearly Vincent learning from the Impressionists. But instead and he did paint some paintings that were sort of loosely Impressionist or loosely pointillist, but he mostly used things he learned from them to continue to develop his own style.
And what was happening, what was like the political climate, the economic climate, the artistic climate like at that time that, how did those factors perhaps bring us Vincent van Gogh?
Well, I think they did less to shape Vincent's art than they did to shape a public that would be a perfect audience for what he did. Meaning, I think one of the things that when we look back at historical movements and the art movements of their day, we can see how a particular artist and a particular zeitgeist come together. And, while Vincent was in Paris and before and after, there was a breaking up of the traditional mechanisms for success, meaning that the mechanism in the early 19th century was to go to an art school, learn how to paint in a kind of academic style, which you learned in the academies. Then you would show your paintings in the annual salon, which had thousands of paintings, and you would see if the world liked what you did. And if the painters who were prized, literally won prizes or at least attracted attention in the salons, would then begin to develop a following, and then would be picked up by Goupil, or one of the other major galleries, but they would certainly hope by Goupil. And that's how you became successful. Well, the salon was breaking down. The academies were breaking down. That very traditional mechanism was breaking down. And all of a sudden, an appearance in a small journal or, showing your paintings in a restaurant, which Van Gogh did, could begin to bring attention to you. And people were looking for not just a new and accomplished expression of an existing painterly style, but for something that was new and authentic. And at that very moment, Vincent was developing this incredibly new, revolutionary even, and extremely authentic art. So it's, you know, it's not so much that the times shaped who Vincent was or what his paintings looked like. It's that the changes in the art world and in the and in the collecting world made them incredibly suitable for what Vincent was independently becoming, if that makes sense.
Well, why were the Salon and the Academy breaking down?
I think it's, you know, I was just thinking as we were talking here, it's not entirely different from what's been going on in our era mm-hmm. with the media. You know, if you think about the fact that, you know, when I was born, everybody's now younger than I am. I was born in 1952. The younger generation don't even know or know from personal experience, there were three networks. You know, if you didn't access, the only way you could access information was from, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And now with this huge multiplicity of platforms, it is possible for things to emerge and to find a following.
You know, well, we can have this conversation and a few thousand
we can
people
have this
can listen.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you have this multiplicity of platforms, and I think that's what was happening in Paris on a different scale, but very similar. You had this one Salon a year, and then all of a sudden, you could become and a couple of major galleries and a couple of major publications, and all of a sudden, you have exhibitions throughout the town. You have multiple small dealers. You have and it becomes increasingly possible for someone to emerge who doesn't follow the traditional path to success.
Right, and for listeners who aren't familiar, the Salon was this yearly exhibition that was an organization that was very official, or even the state was involved.
Yes,
is that correct?
It was originally put on by the state, and they would invite every artist to bring their art, and a committee would look at thousands upon thousands of paintings, and they would pick the ones that they wanted to show. And there, you know, there were still thousands. They were hung from practically the ground to the ceiling in a very large spaces. And, you know, where you hung, what level you were on, depended on how much the committee liked your work. And then they gave prizes to a few of the works. And that was how you had to make yourself known to the art world. And eventually the Salon simply ends. In fact, the impressionism, as we know, it was not just a style, but the artists in that group, Monet and Cezanne and Pizarro and Sisley and some others, began because they were either rejected by the Salon system, or they were angry that their fellow artists were being rejected, and eventually they began the first of several impressionist exhibitions. They basically had a counter exhibition counter to the Salon, and that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that was happening, that was breaking down the hegemony of the Salon system.
Right. It was my French isn't very good, but it's basically Salon of refused artwork.
Yes. Yes. The Salon of refused artwork, or the Salon de refusé, is exactly what it was. What made it possible for this new and slightly revolutionary movement, Impressionism, to emerge.
Well, so these artists were able to put on this Salon, and then I guess there must have been some willing buyers. What was going on that made it possible for this to be economically supported?
Well, I wish I could say that it was terribly successful. It really wasn't. There were some buyers. But even as they broke away from the Salon, it wasn't until much later in their lives that that these painters became successful. In fact, at one point they had an auction at Drouot, and you could buy an impressionist painting for pennies, or at least dollars, because there wasn't really yet enough of a buying public. And in fact, There's some really sad stories from Pizarro, who was begging Theo for money. In fact, Theo concocted this scheme for Vincent to go and live with Pizarro and his family as a way of helping to support Pizarro. So they began to develop a following, but it wasn't until the new century that these artists began to become, you know, seriously important and seriously sought after. And eventually, you know, it wasn't just the French public, but collectors in Germany and England and especially the United States. I mean, there's a reason why there's such huge, great collections of Impressionist painting in all these American museums. I mean, there's, to pick just one, the Art Institute of Chicago, I think, has something like 40 Monets. And it's because all these rich Americans traveling in Europe were among the people who liked the new art and were able to buy these paintings for relatively small prices. Then by the 1920s, people are collecting them and the prices begin to surge. But it took a long while for them to gain acceptance.
1920s, and the Salon of Refused Artwork was, 1874 or so.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you have the number. I wouldn't have been able to pull that date, but I would have thought 70s.
I don't know if that's correct. I'm just saying it's somewhere.
It sounds right. It sounds right to me.
So during that time, there was Impressionism that we normally think of as Impressionism. Like, I think most people think of Monet would be like the 1880s, right? And then Van Gogh really came of age in like the early 1890s. Is that about right?
Late 1880s for Van Gogh, but you know, these artists began to paint earlier. Monet was painting much earlier, but the early Monet comes out of the more traditional styles, and he painted brilliantly at every stage. He lived a very long life. I can't remember if he was in his 80s or even 90s when he died, but he started painting at a young age. So if you look at a career like Monet, it's, you know, it goes over a very long period of time, travels through a multiplicity of styles, and so you can see the evolution of Western art in Monet's career practically.
Mm-hmm. Back to Vincent, obviously he had a lot of difficulty dealing with people, and part of that was perhaps his personality, but he really had a lot of different afflictions, and which would explain why he was in this insane asylum in southern France while he was exploding in popularity. What were the afflictions that that he had?
Well, we don't know for sure. Not everyone agrees, but Greg and I think there were multiple afflictions. I mean, we all know that unfortunately you don't just get one illness necessarily. You can, multiple things can happen to you at the same time, and that was certainly true of Vincent. Greg and I think the main problem was probably epilepsy, a form of epilepsy called temporal lobe epilepsy, and it's less, you don't fall to the ground and foam at the mouth, but the psychological injury and the terror of it is every bit as intense and maybe more so. It's medicated today, but in Vincent's time it wasn't, and he was diagnosed by his own doctors as having epilepsy. There was a lot of epilepsy in his family, and it had to be this form, and they knew about it. They called it in French epilepsie larval, meaning a larval, like a butterfly larvae, because an attack would emerge over time. It had stages. There was a sort of an onset, an awareness that something terrible was happening. Then you would literally lose any sort of conscious awareness of what you were doing or what you were thinking for a period of time. And then as you emerged from that, there was this terrible feeling of exhaustion. It was people were terrified by this. But we also think it's very likely that Vincent had manic depression. And we know that he drank too much, so there was alcoholism in there. And because one of the drinks that was prevalent at the time in which Vincent liked was absinthe, and absinthe had something called wormwood in it, which was a narcotic. So there was that. And on top of all that, Well, he had bad teeth, and he had most of his teeth pulled in Paris. He also had syphilis. But his brother, Theo, died of tertiary syphilis, and Van Gogh doesn't seem to have progressed beyond secondary, but he had terrible stomach problems, and he couldn't sleep well. So, I mean, that's just, and that's not the full catalog of everything that was going wrong with him. But I think, again, what's miraculous to us now is not only did he survive to create these glorious masterpieces and a huge number of them over a short period of time, but he did them in the face of almost no limited financial support from his brother, and almost until the very end, no real acclimation of any kind, and terrible health problems, which I think is really one of the things that makes looking at his art. You don't have to know much about him other than the fact that he cut his ear off, and that, as people used to think, he shot himself, to know that this man had was living a fairly miserable life. And I think there's something almost spiritual about the fact that he accomplished so much, and the fact that the art that he created was so joyous. And he was aware of that. That was conscious. I mean, his favorite line from the Bible was sorrowful, but always rejoicing. And, you know, that really is a kind of sum up of his life, mm-hmm. that, you know, it was sorrowful, but always rejoicing. And I think the people that see the art are not only captivated by the color and the and these iconic compositions, but also by the sense that we all have, no matter how limited or full our awareness is of his life, that he accomplished these things in a difficult time. And that becomes, in a sense, a kind of touchstone for all of us who go through one difficult period or another in our lives, and yet want to triumph over that. And you know, he becomes a symbol of triumph over adversity.
And as you mentioned, he had syphilis. You know, regular visits to a brothel were pretty commonplace back then, and that's probably where that came from. And one of his one of the treatments of syphilis, I thought this was interesting, was mercury pills.
Correct. I mean, some of the medicines were worse than the illnesses. I mean, the mercury was, we hardly need to be told today, was incredibly bad for him, and did very little to correct the syphilis. And there were other medications that were almost equally horrific. Yes, one quarter of all the adult men in Paris had syphilis. So one can't, from this day, this age, this era, look back on it and think that he and Theo were somehow terribly aberrant in having this disease, because it was common. Now, prostitution was rife throughout Europe, and particularly in Paris. And so they were hardly the only men who came down with this mm-hmm. at the time incurable disease.
Well, that mercury could not have helped with the psychological issues either.
No, or his teeth or anything else. Poor guy. I mean, it really is. Greg and I, one of the reasons why, you know, people ask us, how could we spend 10 years writing about this sad life? And there were multiple reasons. One of them was that, you know, it was this triumph over adversity. And in a way, Greg, who my co-author and partner, had a brain tumor from the time I met him when he was 22 until the time he died at 62, and 5 years ago. And I think it was a kind of solace to Greg to watch somebody who had health issues as serious as his accomplish so much. But the other reason, you know, the other thing that sort of kept us going was the fact that he created all these masterpieces. So it's not like this life of misery accomplished nothing. It accomplished astonishing things. And also, for all of his, he may have been intensely annoying, and I'm not sure we would have wanted to be in the room with him, but you know, he was capable of enormous acts of generosity. Not only, I mentioned earlier, did he try to find the good in other artists' work. But he did a number of things that were incredibly selfless. One of them was to leave Paris. You know, everybody always wondered why, after wanting to live with his brother for his entire adult life and having just sort of appeared in Paris and moved in with him, why after 2 years would he just pack his bags and without discussing it, leave? And Greg came up through, because of things in the letters, with the analysis that he really did this because of Theo, that he told his sister, for example, Wilhelmina, that he was terrified that being around Theo was bad for Theo's health. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a self-interested element there because he was so dependent on Theo for money and emotional support. If anything were to have happened to Theo, it would have been terrible for Vincent. But it was also an enormous act of selflessness to pick up and leave so that being around him wouldn't further exacerbate Theo's health issues.
And as you said earlier, a lot of people believe that he committed suicide. I think that the image that is in most people's brains is they imagine this final painting in this wheat field with crows and then cutting off his ear and then killing himself. But none of that really fits together.
No, in fact, the wheat field with crows, it turns out, was painted. It was not in any way the last painting. There were quite a few painted after that. And the last painting was a very cheerful landscape with a bright blue sky. And yes, one of the things that got the most attention in the book, although we put it mostly in an afterword or in an appendix so that it wouldn't sort of dominate the understanding of the last period of his life, was this the fact that we believe, and I believe more strongly now than when the book came out, that that Vincent did not kill himself. It never seemed entirely right. You know, his last letter to Theo was really quite cheerful. It included an order for more paints. He had gone out the day he died to paint. He was ambitious at that moment. It seemed unlikely that anybody would have given him a gun since he had just recently come out of an insane asylum. Guns were terribly rare. What happened to the paint equipment that was out in the fields? What happened to the gun? If he shot it, and also, how did he shoot himself in the stomach? I mean, it turns out there are people who do it. It's incredibly rare. It's incredibly painful. Why didn't he try to shoot himself again? In order to finish the suicide and complete the suicide and end the terrible pain that he suffered from in the last 36 hours of his life. As we were trying to come to terms with all those questions, two things happened. One was that we read this article, which other people had seen, which was an interview with a boy named Gaston Secretan, who was, I think, 16 at the time that summer in 1890 in Aubert. And he and his brother, it was Rene Secretan, he and his brother Gaston knew Vincent. They talked about it, and they all, Rene admits that it was their gun that Vincent used. He claims that Vincent stole it from him, but he also admits that they tortured Vincent. They put pepper on his paintbrush. They put salt in his coffee. They put a snake in his paint box. They had their female friends from Paris pretend to seduce him, Vincent, that is. As all those things, as we're reading all that in the context of these unanswered questions about the death, we found out that there were rumors in Auvers in the early 20th century, as reported by John Rewald, the greatest historian of Impressionism, who was going to, studying at the Sorbonne in the early decades, I think in 19, just before basically the Nazis took over Europe and he had to leave. And he would visit Auvers, not only because Vincent had lived there, but because Pizarro had lived there and Cezanne had lived there. Pizarro lived just north of Auvers, but it was a major sort of resort, or not a resort, but a place where the Impressionists went and stayed when they wanted to get outside, out of Paris in the summer. And it was a place that, that a future historian of Impressionism and Post-Impressionists would go. And he reported that he heard from the villagers, and this would have been in only, you know, 30, 40 years after Vincent died, that the understanding there was that Vincent had not killed himself, but that he had been shot by two bullies, and he had taken the blame for it in order to save their lives. And it, the matchup of that rumor that was prevalent in Auvers, the town where this happened, in combination with the fact that we know who these two boys would have been, René and Gaston Secretan, and the fact that it was their gun, and the fact that this answers all those questions. It also explains what happened to the gun. It explains what happened to the paint equipment. You know, the boys would have gotten rid of that after this. We don't think that it was done intentionally. They were 16 and 18, if I recall, and they drank a lot that summer. And you know, it was more likely the result of a kind of drunken altercation or a game gone awry than it was sort of intentional in any way. But what's interesting to me all these years later, and unfortunately Greg didn't live to see this, but it's sort of become the new narrative. I mean, there have been you know, the two major films on Van Gogh that have come out since our book came out, Loving Vincent, the sort of animated work that was, you know, used recreation of his paintings to tell his story, was the entire film was about was a kind of murder mystery. Did Vincent kill himself, or was he shot by these two boys? And then, of course, the Defoe Schnabel film that came out recently at Eternity's Gate, you know, it doesn't devote a lot of time to it, but it just assumes that he was shot by these two boys and not that instead of killing himself. There's also a short film that, that was done that's appeared at some film festivals that was entirely about the death and about these two boys. And then there was a song that just came out that was sort of a an attempt to encapsulate Vincent's meaning in a song, similar to Don McLean's earlier song, Starry, Starry Night. And in this song, it's all about the two boys killing Vincent. So it certainly has changed. The popular narrative seems to be changing right now.
Mm. Well, in addition to all of the things that you spoke about, there was also a medical report that would make it difficult to understand how he could have shot himself.
Yes, when the Van Gogh Museum is sort of taking different positions, we showed our theory to the sort of key curator at the Van Gogh Museum who knew the life best, and he agreed with us completely based on our argument and the evidence we supplied. We had showed it to some forensic experts, and we showed it to some lawyers who agreed that our theory was more likely, that it was more likely that he was shot by these two boys than he shot himself. but after a while, two people at the Van Gogh Museum wrote an article disagreeing with our theory. And so we submitted our article and our book to a man named Vincent DeMeo, who was one of the top handgun experts in America, and was particularly, and we didn't know him until I just tracked this person down because of his reputation. He was also the leading expert on suicide versus murder. I mean, the cases in which it's uncertain how the person died. And we submitted all this to him, and he came back to us and said, there was no doubt in my mind that Vincent was shot by these two boys. And he partly relied on the angle of penetration as described by the doctors who attended to him, both Dr. Gachet and Dr. Mazzeri, but also the fact that they didn't mention in their description of the injury what he claimed would have been the most, if Vincent had shot himself, the most obvious thing, which would have been that Vincent would have, the gunshot would have seared his flesh, because powderless guns were not available except in and sort of in rifles issued by the military at that time. And if Vincent had shot himself, if the bullet had, if the gun had gone off that close to his body, it would have left this seared flesh, and that would have been, he thought, impossible for these two doctors not to mention, as they described the injury. And on the basis of those facts, he was determined. He was very clear in his mind that that Vincent had been shot by these two boys, and actually conformed to the what we were told in the years after the book came out by forensic experts who read our book.
You already touched on this a little bit about the things that there are to be learned from this life and work, because it seems like such a tragic story. So you've touched on that a little bit about overcoming adversity to do amazing things. I was wondering, is there anything else there? What did you learn? You're an artist yourself from studying Vincent's life.
Well, let me mention something that Greg said in an interview we did shortly after the book came out. And as I mentioned earlier, that Greg had this brain tumor his entire adult life. He had 13 brain operations, and he was in constant pain. I don't want to compare, as Greg would say, I don't want to compare Greg to Van Gogh in any way. But Greg, despite constant pain and 13 brain operations plus kidney cancer and a kidney operation and multiple other health difficulties, managed to write 18 books. He served as an assistant conductor of choruses that performed for Seiji Ozawa and Leonard Bernstein. He helped found two major businesses and took charge of the historic renovation of a major Whitney Vanderbilt estate in South Carolina, and the building of a art collection to fill it. And he did all that in the face of all that difficulty. But something that I think was really important to Greg was the fact that Vincent, he approached every day and every painting as if it might be his last. And the painting that Greg and I loved the most of all the many paintings we loved was the Almond Branches that's in the Van Gogh Museum. It's this wonderful, wonderful shade of blue with these gnarled branches from this old almond tree, and these beautiful, fresh, young blossoms from this tree that has just erupted into bloom. And as Greg said, there's a kind of intensity of looking in that painting, an intention to see every detail of the beauty of that site. It's as if Vincent knew it would be his last, and time to see an almond tree in bloom. And it was. It was the he died the following July, and I think Greg approached his life this way too. He was constantly aware that the end might come, and instead of being sort of depressed into inactivity by that thought, Greg just worked harder and harder and tried to accomplish more and more for two reasons. One, because work sort of was the best antidote to depression. That's something that Vincent not only exemplified in his life, but it was a lesson that he was constantly being taught by his mother, that his mother kept saying over and over again that the answer to sadness was working harder. And you know, Greg exemplified that in his life too. And I think he took some both direction and solace from Vincent, who certainly exemplified that. And I think that might be useful and joyous for anybody out there who's facing either health difficulties or other forms of difficulty. You know, instead of being engulfed in a kind of sadness or gloom, Greg, like Vincent and so many other people, just decided to take as much joy in every single day and every single experience as possible, because he knew that he would not live a long life. And It's a powerful and ennobling and wonderful message. And one reason why this dark and difficult life that Vincent led is ultimately not a gloomy one.
This is a very personal question, so if you don't want to answer it, that's fine. But you've made me curious. I mean, in losing your partner in Greg, this lesson that you have shared with us of what we can learn from Vincent's life, was that something that helped you through that? I mean, you wrote two very long books together and were partners in life as well.
Well, I was so overwhelmed by the loss that basically, I'm sure it would be called a depression. I really shut down completely for a couple of years, because not only had we lived together for 40 years, but we wrote these books together and we did everything together. I mean, we were together all day long. All those things I mentioned Greg did, except for the music. And we did put together a music festival with the Juilliard School together, but I didn't conduct those things with him. Other than the conducting of the music, all of the things we did together. Plus we watched movies and just talked, and all the sort of things that weren't involved in our professional careers that we did together. So when he died, even though I sort of knew it was going to happen someday, I just didn't allow myself to think about it very much. And then when it happened, I just shut down. I think as I began to emerge from that, then those lessons became really important. And instead of regretting the fact that I have to live the rest of my life without him, I try to take I'm more aware of the things in my current life, the people who are still in it. You know, my mother's still alive, thank goodness, at age 90. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of really close friends. And, you know, there's someone in my life now. And and I think I'm more consciously aware of those joys. I look back on the times that Greg was alive, and I regret the fact that I didn't treat each, even though I knew he had this terrible illness, and even every time that I waited during a brain surgery for the doctor to come out and tell me whether he'd survived or not, even with all that, I just obviously didn't allow myself to think it would ever really happen. And as a result, I wasn't overly conscious of how lucky I was that he survived and that we had all that time together. And I think from this perspective, I'm much more aware of it than I was then. But Greg was aware of it then. I think he was intensely aware that he wasn't going to live a natural life, and that he needed to get as much out of every moment. I didn't really learn that lesson until after he died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the lesson is to look at every detail as it's happening.
It's to enjoy everything, because you never know if it's your last. I was sort of so caught up in keeping him alive, first of all, and getting him to the right medical care. And then making sure these things got done. I was consumed by the effort. Greg did manage to experience it all more fully, I think, because he knew it wouldn't go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you assume that there's an afterlife, and therefore just sort of assume that this life is only one of many stages, or if you don't believe in an afterlife, I think most of us sort of suspend belief in our own mortality as mm-hmm. a way of functioning in what is, for everyone, a truncated life. And I think reading about Vincent van Gogh and how he approached his life I think it's a valuable thing to fully experience the joys that we are given and the beauty in the life that we are given.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, thank you so much for sharing all of this and for writing this incredible book with Greg. It's a treasure. It's 900 some pages, but every single page of it is wonderful and fascinating. And I really encourage everybody to go and check that out. And is there any other place where, if people are interested in more of Van Gogh the life and in your work, where they can find that?
Well, some of the people, we had some wonderful people working with us on the research on Van Gogh, and they have generated both on Instagram and on Facebook a page that has a new work of Van Gogh's every single day. So I would encourage you, a wonderful woman named Beth Moore, selects and presents this every day. And it's a wonderful thing to wake up every morning and see this glorious work by Van Gogh. There is a website that Greg and I put together for the book that has all the footnotes. We have 6,000 pages of footnotes. I've been told by some major librarians that it's the most substantial footnotes for a single volume book ever. And it was only made possible by the existence of the internet. So you can go to Van Gogh, the life, and see, and there's some photographs there and timelines and other things about the life. And then my own work can be seen at stephenap.com. And I'm busy making works of art, and museums have been acquiring it as well as private collectors. And that's actually, it's interesting, Greg sort of encouraged me. I'd worked as an artist before my other careers, and Greg, about 20 years ago, encouraged me to go back to work. And I think it was him understanding that he wouldn't be around to do the things we did together, and that my art career would be something that would sustain me after he was gone. And he was right, as he was so in just about everything else. Mm-hmm. But anyway, thank you for the question, and thank you very much for this conversation. It's always a pleasure to talk about Vincent and the miracle of his life and the miracle of his art and the joy that it brings to all of us.
Well, I have really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much, Steve Nafe.
Take care. Thank you, David.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of this show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/cadavy. That's patreon.com/KA, D as in David, A, V as in Victor, Y. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsors Roxana Maynard of Agility Alchemist at agilityalchemist.com and Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.